How do you like your coffee? Freshly roasted? You can just smell it, can't you? Well, how would you like it brought to you? If you're passionate about your coffee, then a Passion for the Bean is for you. At a Passion for the Bean, they custom roast coffee beans from around the world when you place your order, so your coffee is guaranteed to be fresh, rich, full-bodied, and full of flavor. That's not the taste that you get from coffee beans that have been sitting on a supermarket or coffeehouse shelf for weeks. Now, to have the ultimate coffee experience delivered to your home or office, call a Passion for the Bean at 480-703-2326. That's 480-703-BEAN. A Passion for the Bean has joined forces with the American Stroke Association in the fight to end stroke. Now, you can help by purchasing an ASA signature blend, and 30% of the proceeds will go directly to the ASA. Help us put an end to stroke. The life you save may be your own. And call a Passion for the Bean today, 480-703-2326.
From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and we're here every week to deal with mental health issues from a more holistic perspective, which means body, mind, and spirit, and learning how to awaken yourself to the possibility that finding balance in our lives in body, mind, and spirit can actually bring more balance to our world. And in terms of talking about balance in our world, this week we're actually going to be dealing with some very strong issues and a history that has gotten the world very much out of balance. We're going to be talking about AIDS, 25 years and still counting. Now, we all know that the truth will set you free, but the question we ask on this show is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? So if we're talking about AIDS, we're definitely talking about the concept of freedom. We're talking about the concept of freedom from fear, freedom from ignorance, freedom from stigma, freedom from the terror that being infected can bring to many people and brings to most people. The freedom from the ignorance that's still going on all over this world, and particularly in this country, in terms of the idea that real prevention programs can actually slow down and put a stop to the infection of this virus. It's been proven in Uganda many years ago and in a lot of other places where very effective and comprehensive prevention programs can really help stop the spread of this virus. And we're going to be talking about prevention. We're going to be talking about a lot of things tonight in terms of the history. But unfortunately, we are 25 years into this epidemic, and we are still counting, and there's no end in sight, not just here in Phoenix or Los Angeles or in the U.S., but there's no end in sight anywhere on this planet. So I want to also acknowledge that I'm dedicating tonight's show to the memory of a friend and colleague of mine named Brian Miller, a clinical psychologist who was actually born just a few months after myself in 1950 and passed away in April of this year from complications of AIDS. Brian Miller was a clinical psychologist in Los Angeles, also a incredible therapist, and wrote an amazing column years ago in Edge magazine, a gay periodical, called Out for Good, which was actually an advice column in this gay and lesbian periodical. So my point in dedicating tonight's show to Brian Miller is, because he deserves it, he deserves a great deal of acknowledgement, but also so that we all know that people in this country are still dying from complications of HIV and AIDS. And Brian lived with this disease for at least 15 years or more. And I just want to send my condolences out to his partner, 24 years, Bernard Cooper, and to all of those in the Los Angeles community that feel his loss. My experience with HIV and AIDS, gratefully, does not come from a personal infection, but from what we always have talked about as an infection that has affected all of us, in the sense that if you've lived, particularly in this country, in the gay community, going back to the 80s through the 90s, whether you're infected personally in your own body or not, there was no way of avoiding the impact of this virus. As a professional, as a psychotherapist, of course, I started dealing with a great number of clients that were dealing with the terror of what this new thing was going back to the mid-80s, and compounding that with my own terror as a gay man of not knowing really whether or not I was going to be dead or alive within a year from then. And it was just an amazing period to be in, especially in our 20s and 30s and 40s, when none of us were really experiencing or expecting to be dealing with illness and death in a way that maybe our elderly parents were expecting to be dealing with at their ages. And this is an epidemic and a wave of death I don't think this country had seen since the flu epidemic in the early 1900s. So all of us were taken quite by surprise as a professional and as a human being, living in terror and dealing with friends and clients and colleagues who were getting ill, who were dying, and at the beginning, and none of us knew what or why. And it was one of those periods in history that affected everyone. Particularly, we're going to talk tonight about what happened in this country. But we're going to be talking about what's going on worldwide also. Now, we very often separate in our own consciousness physicians, whether they're men or women, as these people in white coats that have the answers and always know what to do. And for a lot of us, we've been taught as we're growing up that doctors know everything and we don't question what they're saying. We do what we're told, and almost as if it's this parental authority figure. But something started happening 25 years ago or 26 years ago that stumped even the physicians. And one physician that started putting pieces of the puzzle together in Los Angeles is a Dr. Michael Gottlieb, who's somebody that I've known here in Los Angeles for many years, and I respect so much. He's actually my own physician, my own personal physician. And I've seen how he's handled clients and friends of mine over the years, and his name is often associated with the beginnings and currently with HIV and AIDS. Because he was the physician that back in 1985 started seeing a trend with gay male patients that were coming into his office. And he was the one that actually wrote the first piece in the medical journals that actually put this trend together that woke up a great number of physicians all over this country who were seeing the same thing but hadn't made the connections that Dr. Gottlieb has made. So my guest tonight, and I'm very grateful for him taking some time out on his Friday evening to join us, Dr. Michael Gottlieb. You there, Dr. Gottlieb?
I am. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, how you doing this evening?
Very well, thanks. What you said about physicians and certainty really struck a chord with me, because a lot of our training, it's not well appreciated, but a lot of our training has to do with our ability to tolerate uncertainty. Because medicine, as you know, is an art as well as a science, but we sometimes don't have all the scientific facts, as was the case with the first patients with AIDS.
Well, let's go back there because, again, what I do on the show is talk about mental health issues, and my point in making that opening statement was the fact that most of us don't realize that physicians are humans and have their own issues of mental health and emotional well-being that they're dealing with. And when they come across something like what I imagine, what I know you came across 25 years ago and had the scientific support, but also I would think some intuitive sense that these pieces go together. What was it like for you on, I mean, you were 33 years old. You were seeing some things that didn't make sense to you and yet started making sense to you, but how did all this affect you as a physician and as a human being? I mean, what was going through you at this time as you started seeing these five or six gay men with these unusual symptoms?
Well, it was an awful experience, distinctly unpleasant, shocking to see young people, in this case our first patient was 31, critically ill, previously healthy, but all of a sudden critically ill with pneumocystis pneumonia. And it was very difficult. I was 33, this first patient 31. As physicians, we're not well trained to care for our contemporaries, and it was very difficult seeing someone previously healthy kind of wither away with one infection after another. It was also frightening because after several cases came in, we began to suspect that there might be an infectious cause. We, of course, wondered, gee, were we the canaries in the coal mine? In other words, were we possibly unknowingly exposed to some virus or other microbe that was, in fact, destroying the immune system of these patients? And would we face a similar fate coming down with multiple infections? And my colleagues and I did worry about that, and we worried whether we were going to bring some infection home to our families. And this uncertainty actually lasted several years until the HIV antibody test was developed in 1985, and we were all tested, and despite lots of exposure to our patients, exposure to various secretions, and oftentimes not wearing gloves, fortunately, none of us were infected with HIV.
Mm-hmm. So, again, that's like the human side of this is here you were not knowing and still showing up every day in your office, still treating the patients that you were seeing, not knowing how much at risk you yourself were being put in, as well as the potential for your families and loved ones. And yet a lot of people, I think, don't give physicians like yourself the kind of credit for the day-to-day courage it takes sometimes to keep showing up when you know that somebody needs your care.
Well, Stuart, as a psychotherapist, you know that the powers of denial are very, very powerful. And
yeah.
It's part of your training to show up and to do your job. None of us really ever believe that we're going to find ourselves in the eye of the storm and in the center or at the very beginnings of an epidemic, and it does happen, fortunately, rarely.
Well, again, that's what I was saying in my opening, too, because if, none of us, even as therapists, thought we were going to be in this position, and even those that were not doctors or therapists like ourselves, but the fact that in this country the first wave hit the gay community, you could ask anybody in the 80s and 90s if we thought that as gay men and as the lesbian community that came forward to really be a support the way they did, that we would be in the middle of a emotional and not just emotional but a medical situation which became the focal point, really, for a great deal of political situations for the gay community.
I agree. I think one of the untold stories has been the incredible valor of people, not just doctors and nurses, but therapists and political activists, in the way they approached this mysterious and frightening epidemic. There was, as you well know, a great deal of neglect on the part of the federal health authorities, with very little in the way of resources put forward to deal with AIDS in the very first years of the epidemic. And the gay community, the gay and lesbian community, had to rally and create service organizations to intervene in the crisis. When,
in a sense, to take care of our own.
Absolutely, and the gay community did. And now there is this extraordinary expertise in the community that continues to need to be applied to people who are still living with, for people who are still living with HIV and AIDS. And there's so much expertise that the community has to offer other communities who are just beginning to deal with their HIV/AIDS issues.
And I want to get into... Go ahead.
And that goes for emerging populations in this country, the African-American community, which still has not come to grips with AIDS, the Hispanic community, and other communities overseas who are just beginning to be aware of the crisis in their midst.
Well, I definitely want to get into all of that, because today's show is not just about the medical issues, because I know that you yourself have not just been a medical professional in the course of the last 25 years, but you've been also in the trenches of the psychosocial organizations that have needed your assistance and help, some to actually get started, but also the political issues. Before we get into all that, I want to remind my listeners that this is a live show tonight, and if you're driving home in Phoenix or you're listening on your radio, or if you're listening via the internet outside the Phoenix area, the phone number, if you have a question for myself or Dr. Gottlieb, or if you have some comments, some experience of your own, or if you're disagreeing with some of what we're talking about tonight, then the number to call in the Phoenix area is area code 480-949-1310. That's 480-949-1310. So let's get back to the beginnings, because before the end of the show, I really want to talk about how astonishing it is to me that after 25 years, there are still so many people out there, even within the gay and lesbian community, who really don't know how this virus is transmitted, and that there are still so many myths about it, and I want to get into that. But I want to go back to the earlier days. You wrote an editorial on June 5th, which was actually the date that your first piece appeared in the medical journals about the cases that you were seeing. And you even wrote, "It is still astonishing to me that a disease that spread from chimpanzees to humans in Central Africa, probably as early as the 1930s, was first detected in West Los Angeles in 1981. In retrospect, we know that HIV had traveled to the U.S. shores as early as 1977, and the earliest known HIV-positive blood sample is from 1959, obtained from an unknown man in Kinshasa, Congo, and frozen. Since my first report to the CDC, more than 500,000 people have died of AIDS in the United States. Globally, 25 million people have died of the disease, which is now the leading cause of death worldwide among those between the ages of 15 and 59. Now, in those short paragraphs, you really kind of bring in the whole history of the questions, where did this come from? How did it get here? And it also, I think, brings up the issues of who's getting this, where is it going, who are these 25 million people that have died, and the statistics say that another 40 to 45 million are living but infected. You know, you started mentioning other than the gay population. Talk about who's getting this right now.
Well, in the U.S., people in the African American and Latino community are disproportionately getting HIV. Crossover from men who are bisexual, also a lot of crossover as a result of intravenous drug use, with people becoming infected through IV drug use and then possibly passing the infection on sexually. So the and a lot of an overwhelming number of people in the African-American community and Hispanic communities who are contracting HIV are heterosexual. So the epidemic is moving, becoming more like the epidemics around the world where the overwhelming majority of people affected by HIV are heterosexual. I think one aspect of the epidemic that has not been adequately appreciated is that it is an epidemic of young people, of sexually active people. And that's where risk reduction measures and education and knowing the facts about how the virus is transmitted come into play. I know we're going to speak later about the rest of the world, but just as an illustration, in sub-Saharan Africa, approximately half of new adult HIV infections are in the age range 15 to 24. And in that age group, teens and young adults living in sub-Saharan Africa, three-quarters of HIV-positive young people are in that age group. So that there's disproportionate representation, particularly of young women, in sub-Saharan Africa. In other words, most young people with HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa are girls. And there are lots of reasons for that, but some of the same reasons why we're seeing an increase in the among women here in the U.S.
Which is?
Well, glad you asked. Which is basically the inferior status of women economically and the lack of human rights that exists, particularly for young women in sub-Saharan Africa, but to some extent the economic dependency of young women on men here in the United States as well. Issues of assertiveness, issues of insistence on condom use, and in Africa in particular, there's an issue of rape that has not been adequately addressed.
Well, there was a two-part special on PBS that actually addressed a lot of what you're talking about, and I actually watched the whole thing. It was in two parts, 2 hours each, and you were actually interviewed in a couple of the pieces on it. And one of the things I really appreciated about this is that 25 years into this, PBS did an excellent job of talking about the history and moving in and out of the issues of how this was impacted by the gay community and how it impacted the gay community. But the beauty of this four-hour piece was the fact that it really dealt equally with the impact of, like you're talking about, sub-Saharan Africa and the minorities in this country and how it's spread and how the epidemic has really exploded in Asia and the former Soviet Union and things like that. The beauty of that piece was really that if anybody watched it, they would really get to see that this is a worldwide concern, heterosexually, homosexually, young or old. And what you're talking about in Africa is something that was able to be just pushed to the background years ago because, you know, the politicians back then really didn't care about the blacks dying in Africa and didn't care about gays dying in this country. So they're able to close their eyes, and there was actually a bumper sticker that Cleve Jones talked about in one of the interviews that said, AIDS, it's killing all the right people. And that was something that was he had seen on a car back in the mid-'80s. And that's the attitude that was going on then. And unfortunately, it's still a predominant attitude amongst many fundamentalists here today.
I agree. I let me first say that that Frontline show on PBS was outstanding, and it is available, I believe, on DVD. And for anyone who has an interest in the history of AIDS and the current state of the AIDS epidemic, I'd strongly recommend getting access to that.
Well, a simple way of doing it is actually by going to pbs.org and doing a search for the program called The Age of AIDS, and you can actually see the whole documentary on your computer for free on pbs.org. I know. I mean, that's how I got to watch the first 2 hours, because my TiVo had deleted it. So I actually got to watch the whole thing on pbs.org yesterday. So it can be viewed.
To get back, Stuart, to Cleve's bumper sticker, I think that was certainly true here in the United States. When the AIDS epidemic broke out in 81, the White House policy advisor was a man named Gary Bauer, who ironically wrote an op-ed piece that was on the same page as my editorial on June 5th, 2006. It was on a different subject, but ironically, he was the author. And he is a conservative right-wing Christian, and he strongly influenced the domestic policy agenda, which was not to respond to any epidemic among gay men and intravenous drug users. It was just the wrong people to spend federal resources on. And that got us way behind in our response to the HIV epidemic here.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, folks like Jesse Helms got on board and in 1987 issued his famous pronouncement that no federal dollars were ever to go for risk reduction education among gay men because it would promote a homosexual lifestyle.
Well, I want to interrupt there somewhat, because he proposed that and put the bill on the floor of the Senate, but the bill passed by a vote of 94-2.
Which,
and people
something.
Don't understand that that's still the law of the land today.
Exactly. And young men and women are still contracting HIV today because the federal government feels that to tell them how to protect themselves will promote a homosexual lifestyle. It was the same argument that suggested that providing intravenous drug users with clean needles would encourage young people to take up intravenous drug use. Totally illogical.
Well, as illogical as it was, because even as close as Reagan was back then to Thatcher, England took a very different approach to the needle exchange and actually reduced the number of infections within the IV drug community, and thus reduce the number of ancillary infections heterosexually, because they allowed the needle exchange program.
And in the gay community in England, the public information that was promulgated about the AIDS epidemic most likely resulted in a decrease of HIV infection among gay men. I had occasion to speak to a young gay nurse, or actually my age now,
That's young.
Somewhat younger. At Peter Sinai Medical Center, a young British guy who told me that he recalls the public campaigns of the Thatcher government, and he believes that the infection rate among his contemporaries was significantly lower than the infection rate that happened here in the U.S. Because the government, despite a conservative ideology, government got behind it. The difference here in the U.S. is that it was a religious conservative ideology that prevented getting the word out. And the irony of this, of course, is that once the Christian right perceived that these folks in Africa, these poor African folks, were getting HIV in such large numbers, and what a genocide it is, in fact, in sub-Saharan Africa, they have gotten behind the movement to prevent HIV and to treat HIV in Africa, a situation they could never embrace here in the United States because the epidemic involved gay men and IV drug users at the start.
Well, the PBS Frontline piece also showed very clearly that it was the younger Graham who actually had a much more open attitude about attacking this and actually at a meeting of fundamentalist Christians at a certain point a number of years ago, couched it to them as if it's their godly duty to go to Africa and save those souls, and he put it to them in the form of, this is an opportunity to go convert all these people and save their souls, and at the same time help these people that are dying of HIV and AIDS. And that was seemed to be the motivation that finally got a lot of the churches on board to do it there.
I think there is some of that. I think a lot of the religious groups and even the evangelical groups are doing some excellent work in Africa, and they are making a difference. Sometimes there are, however, strings attached to, and at least a hope on their part that their efforts are going to result in religious conversions as well as preventing HIV conversions.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the other really successful things in Africa, according to the, well, I've heard this for a long time, actually, was in Uganda, who actually... once they got over the dictatorship, their president actually came on board immediately as a spokesperson to start a prevention program that they called ABC, which is basically abstinence first, be faithful to your partner so you're not having multiple partners, and if those are not possible for you, use a condom. And it showed and it proved that that attitude and that approach and the president of the country being the main spokesperson for it actually decreased the number of infections and deaths in a sub-Saharan African country. And then our president, Bush, actually went there to show it, to praise them, and then put conditions on any funding that we might give them, which is what usually goes on with any federal funds that go anywhere else in the world, that as long as they're promoting the condom use, that the funds won't come. And the president there actually started making changes to what was actually working.
Right,
because
of
the attitude that our government has. Yeah.
I did hear that, and it certainly was a well... I would say two things. The first is that the when a government leader, whether it be Thatcher or the president of Thailand or the president of Uganda, takes a stand, things happen for the better.
Mm-hmm.
That people follow and people are alerted to the problem. And so AIDS is such a situation that has to be embraced at the very highest levels of government to get the word out, to destigmatize it, because stigma is what fuels the spread of HIV. And when the president can utter the word AIDS and talk about how to prevent it, that has enormous stature in people's eyes. Whether it be abstinence or faithfulness or condom use, whatever it takes, these measures are important. Condom use is essential. And unfortunately, our government puts a lot of strings on controls the purse strings and de-emphasizes condom use both in its programs abroad and here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. So I want to remind my listeners, if you have a comment or a question for Dr. Gottlieb or myself on this issue of AIDS, the number is 480-949-1310. Now, going back to the early days for you as a physician dealing with an issue that you really were not able to cure and at the beginning not even treat effectively, how did you feel about Reagan's silence and the federal government's avoidance of dealing with this issue at all? How did it affect you personally?
Well,
and professionally?
I was personally crushed. Here I had come upon something I thought was important. People were dying, people were at risk, and yet the response was one of neglect. And it hurt. It made things so much harder to try and scare up funds to do research when the funds were not immediately available from the government. I think I felt what it feels like to be a minority in this country,
mm-hmm.
that you have no voice and that you have no stature.
And people don't care.
and people don't care, and it became quite the it's very dispiriting and demoralizing.
How did you cope with that? I mean, what did you do for yourself in order to keep going through and keep doing what you needed to do?
I'm not sure, but I think my patients continued to inspire me. I felt that whatever I was doing for them, even before antiviral drugs were available, was a positive thing. Sometimes it's important, as you know, as a therapist, is just to be there and to do hand-holding and to explain. And there's a lot more to helping than writing a prescription.
Mm-hmm. Stuart, we have Pam from Women at Risk on the line.
Ah, okay. We got a caller. Pam, how you doing? You're from Los Angeles, aren't you?
Yes, I am, Stuart. Hi, how are you?
And it's good to hear from you because, you know, Pam is somebody that I've known for years. I don't know, Dr. Gottlieb, if you know Pam, but I would appreciate it, Pam, if you told a little bit of your story before you made your comment or question.
Sure, sure. Hi, Dr. Gottlieb, by the
Hello,
way.
Pam.
Thank you so much for doing this and being there with Stuart. It's such an important anniversary for all of us. I'm Pam Yelsky. I live in Redondo Beach, California, and I actually met Stuart through his support group that he has facilitated that started off as the Hayride, Louise Hay support group, and I met him in early 1992 when I was first diagnosed myself with AIDS. And my husband actually knew about Louise Hay and her work, and within a week of my diagnosis, I think I was at my first meeting where Stuart was the facilitator up in West Hollywood. And I'm still attending that particular support group. Now it has shrunk, of course, over the years, and I'm grateful that it was there then because... As you said earlier on in the show, it's not all about just the medical aspect and taking the right drugs and doing everything our doctor tells us. It's about the emotional and the spiritual part of taking care of us as well. And Stuart's support group really, really, really helped me along in the early years and continues to do that. What I'm doing today, I'm also the president of the board of an organization called Women at Risk. It's a Culver City-based organization. We're known in the community as a small but mighty agency, and we offer support group and services and to women and their families living with HIV and AIDS. In the greater Los Angeles, San Fernando Valley area, we also offer monolingual Spanish-speaking groups, and we do outreach in the community. We have a very powerful speakers bureau. We go out and do speaking engagements with an organization called Being Alive, and we're trying to teach prevention as well. And as you talked about, there really is a chance to prevent the spread of this disease. And the young people today, I really think we have the opportunity to have an entire generation of HIV-free adults if they understand and hear the message of what they can do to protect themselves.
I actually was going to call you this week to see if you would call into the show because I know that you would have such important stuff to add, and I think dealing with the woman's perspective is very important, and it's not something that really gets dealt with enough, which is what Dr. Gottlieb has been saying all along, that this is, you know, this part of our population is underrepresented and is on the one of the fastest growing groups in terms of infection. But you have your hands full with not just your own infection right now, which is why I wasn't going to impose on you, because you're not, if it's okay with you, you're not the only one in the family with HIV, correct?
Well, do I have a moment to share the rest of that story? Because
please.
It is rather profound. I actually came home tonight, Stuart, early because I read your email, and I'm here with my mother at home. I took an early shift at the hospital, and my husband is currently there with our son, and because I wanted to come home, and if at all possible, if I thought the phone lines would be totally busy and I may not be able to get through, but by God, I was going to try. So my son, I refer to him as my son. He's been the child of my heart for the last 18 years, but he is my stepson. He is 24 years old, and he was infected at birth from a blood transfusion in 1982. And right now he is really putting up a good fight, and actually we got great news earlier in the week. He's battling lymphoma, HIV-related, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma for the second time in the last 10 years. And so he is in the hospital for the second round of chemotherapy, and just for extra excitement, they've also discovered that he has a little subdural hematoma, and so they're monitoring that. But we're about a third of the way through the second phase, and if there's a higher power, God, universe, whatever you believe in that has power over our lives, I really believe that I met my husband for a reason. When I met him in 1988, I did not know that I was positive. He told me right up front that he had a son who had AIDS, and that if I had issue with that, then we didn't need to go out on a second date. And 2 years later, his 8-year-old son walked me down the aisle to marry his dad. And the bond was immediate. It was immediate. We didn't know then, again, that I was also walking around and had been walking around since 1981. With the virus, because I was a heterosexual woman, because I wasn't an IV drug user, because I was white, middle class, all of the problems, health issues that I had over the years that were screaming HIV, they were never addressed, even when I asked a doctor. I had a lot of female problems and lots of different things going on that were clear indicators now, of course, but even in the mid-80s, in 88, they're still, well, we don't need to test you. When I asked to be tested because I was so sick, a doctor said, well, you're not in a high-risk group. There's no need to test you. Had I been tested in April of 88, which is when I first met my husband, and found out then, I don't know where our relationship would have gone. Certainly, why would a man who's already dealing with a child who they didn't know if he was going to live to be 6 years old, why would he take on a new relationship with a woman who had HIV as well? So I really believe things happened for a reason, because we didn't find out until January of 92, when had already been married for a while. We'd been together almost 4 years. We were going to try to have a baby, and we just thought it was responsible for us to take blood tests, and that's how I found out. And what that did was it created a situation where my son, my stepson, could feel safe and have someone that he could identify with. When we told him that he was HIV positive, because we didn't tell him until he was 10. And when it got to a point where we couldn't pawn the medications off as being vitamins or to help him grow, or we couldn't do that anymore, and we really felt then he was old enough and mature enough to help himself and understand that what he could do with his mind and the power of staying positive and helping be a part of his good health, you know, whether that his mental health, his physical health, and be a participant in it, then we told him, and we told him that I was also HIV positive as well. And we were on the same medication regimen back then. You know, in the early days, we were taking exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. So it really ended up being a gift. And that sounds crazy, and a lot of people who are listening are going to think she's out of her mind, but maybe I am a little bit. It does help during times of insanity. It helped both of us, I think, because mm-hmm. we walked through it together, and yeah. we've shared the experience together. And when he was 6, they said, my God, he's 6. You know, he was 1 pound, 10 ounces at birth. He had this blood transfusion. He got HIV. They said, well, if you're lucky, he'll live to be 4. And at 4, they said, you're lucky if he'll live to be 6. And when he was 6, it was like, my God, if you have him till he's 8, what a gift. He's 24. He's mm-hmm. still here, and he's fighting, and he fights. He's fighting every day, and Stuart knows that since Stuart's known our family, he's had more challenges in his very short lifetime than a lot of people have had, you know, who live to be 80 and 90 years old.
I really want to thank you, because I know you've been at the hospital, and Jerry's been at the hospital with Bo quite a bit, and I really want to thank you for getting home to call in tonight and for telling this story.
Because Stuart, can I ask Pam a question?
Yes, please.
Pam, that's a remarkable personal story, and thank you for sharing it with us and the listeners. I wanted to ask you about women at risk, and whether there are efforts going on in terms of prevention among minority women, and are minority women part of Women at Risk?
Yes, they are. As a matter of fact, we have we had to actually split one of our groups, our Spanish-speaking groups, because it was such a large group that it meets a couple of times a month, and it's a very active group, as is our Women of Color group, and the Spanish-speaking group is a little bit different than the rest of our groups. Most of our other groups are predominantly for the women. The women go and are supported, but in the Latin community, the women the wives don't go anywhere without the husbands. So it's a family affair. Everyone comes to group. So we have child care on site. The kids are taken care of. They play, they color, they watch videos. And the wives attend the support group with their spouses or significant others. So it's a different dynamic, but it definitely, as you mentioned earlier, Dr. Gottlieb, is in the African American communities and the Latino communities, the rate of infection is very, very high.
And it's still not talked about enough.
It is not. It is, and that's part of the work that we do. And our speakers bureau, when we go out into the schools, we go wherever they will let us come in. We would like to get in at the junior high level. That doesn't always happen. Sometimes it's high, you know, a lot of times it's high schools. We go into colleges, and we do prevention. We teach. That's what our speakers bureau does, is to teach prevention and how to because everybody. Or I shouldn't say that's a blanket statement, but especially down in the South Bay where I live, Redondo Beach, Hermosa Beach, Manhattan Beach, Palos Verdes, it's an upper middle class area, and what we find when we go into those schools, that's where the prevention and education is needed the most, because these kids are living under the impression that because they live in a certain area that HIV and AIDS doesn't exist in their world. And that's why it's so powerful for someone like me to walk in and say, guess what? I was 21 years old and living in the South Bay, and la 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 la, and oh, I'm having a great life and a good time, and who worries about a condom? We had the pill, and guess what? It didn't matter that I lived in that I came from a middle class family and had a fairly normal childhood and you know, was considered myself a fairly well educated young woman, a bright woman. This virus, this disease, is an equal opportunity disease. It doesn't care whether you're a man or a woman or a child or black or white or rich or poor, and getting that message out there is really difficult. Because
it's difficult. I think there's an epidemic out there of people believing they don't need to take precautions.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, I think it's the same impact that Bo had in high school when he came out about being HIV positive in the school, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He was
that
very
really
courageous.
Brought it home to that whole school.
It did. He was very courageous. A very white bread Manhattan Beach school. He was in a program called Peer Outreach, and he actually ended up speaking his senior year there to the entire senior class, and basically came out about his health status. And extremely, extremely brave, because you don't talk about things like that in, you know, in a little community that's kind of Mayberry RFD. And he is very powerful, and I really believe that he is here for a specific reason. And Stuart and I have had this conversation because he's been through it, you know, been to hell in a handbasket and back again, and he's battled depression issues, and why wouldn't he? And he's come back from the brink of so many different things, and I really believe it's because there's some important work out there. He's here for a reason, and I really believe that he's got a message. He's got a very powerful story, and that he gets young people's attention. You know, they will pay attention to him. They'll listen to him probably before they'll listen to me.
Well, he gets the attention of a lot of adults, too.
Yeah, he does.
Because one of the points of what I really wanted to bring home on this show tonight, which is really coming across loud and clear right now, is that in 25 years, people have become complacent that we now have these drug cocktails. We're not seeing, even in West Hollywood and the Castro area or the Village or any gay area of any city, we're not seeing the Kaposi sarcomas and the wasting guys walking down the street and things like that. But what we're having on this show tonight, number one, is a gay male host who's been through this epidemic, a heterosexual white doctor who's been through this epidemic, a white heterosexual woman who's been infected and definitely been through some real horror stuff with your own health, you know, your teenage or now 24-year-old son, and then the dedication to Brian Miller, who's a gay man who's lived with this for over 15 years, who still had the wasting problem. And the whole issue is, when we're talking about the minority groups, this is what this whole community is about. In terms of what's going on in this country and around the world today, it's everybody. It's not one specific group. And I'm really glad you called in, because I think it's really bringing that point home.
Well, I thank you for letting me have the time, Stuart, and I feel like I should let someone else have a turn, but I really appreciate you're being out there, you know, and the work that you do, and, you know, it's so, so important, and you know what you mean to me on a personal level, but and what you continue to do in the community, it's so important that we do talk about it, and that's why I just had to call in, because 25 years later, there's still this terrible stigma attached to this disease that isn't attached to cancer or, you know, or breast cancer or multiple sclerosis or some, you know, you say that you have that, one of those diseases to someone, and it's, oh, you know, what can I do, blah, 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 and you say you have AIDS, and still today it really slays me that all these years later they want to know, well, how did you get it? Like, my son, bless his little heart, he got it from a blood transfusion, so that's okay, but I had a good time. I was 21 years old. I had unprotected sex, so there's a different, you know, it's a different, people feel differently, and that shouldn't be. It doesn't really matter how we got it. We're all in this boat together, and if we're going to survive this epidemic, we really have to just get rid of all those preconceived notions that we have about the disease, and just know that it is a disease that people that we are living with it. Your friend did pass from it. There still are a lot of challenges out there, and we are still losing people, but more people are living with it as a result of the regimens and the things that are available to us. However, you know, we all know that there are a lot of side effects with that too.
Okay, we only have a few minutes left, Pam, so I really want to get back to Dr. Gottlieb, but I also want the listeners to know that I will be putting the link up to your website, Women at Risk, so that they can get in touch with you via tellthetruthfaster.com, and you've been a guest on my show in the past, and that show is archived, and people can listen to more of your story and a lot of your wisdom, which you're one of the wisest women I know, so I want to thank you for calling in.
Thank you,
and
Stuart.
And give Jerry and Bo my best.
All right. Thank you, Stuart. I love you. And thank you, Dr. Gottlieb.
Thank you, Pam.
All right. Good night.
Kind of brings the point home, doesn't it, Dr. Gottlieb?
It does. It's not somebody else's problem. It's all of our problem. And we have to somehow destigmatize it and bring it into the mainstream so that more people can know about it and not have such strong negative feelings about it, and pitch in and do something constructive about it.
Now we have about 2 minutes left, and I know that we've just really begun to scratch the surface. What, in 60 seconds, what is it that we haven't discussed, or what point do you really want to bring home, maybe about prevention or your own sense of things today politically and socially with HIV and AIDS?
I think in terms of prevention, we have to start educating young people and get over our hang-ups about educating young people about sex, and start it at an earlier age, and teach girls in particular that they have more control over situations And we have to emphasize condom use because we know that, teens are having sex. And unfortunately, this information is kind of buried now on in U.S. government websites. The condoms as a means of HIV prevention have been demoted behind abstinence. And abstinence is fine for some people, but condoms do work. That's been shown in Thailand and Uganda and other places.
So well, it was shown here even in the gay community when infections dropped tremendously because of the prevention programs that were going on.
And so these are simple things, and to not tell people, not give people the information they need, just continues the kind of neglect that we saw to the epidemic from the get-go.
Well, I really want to thank you again, Dr. Gottlieb, for being a part of tonight's show. We'd love to do it again with you and get into more aspects of this topic of 25 years with HIV and AIDS. And I want to, just what Pam said to me, I want to bounce right over to you. I tremendously respect who you are as a doctor and as a human being and your level of commitment to this and the insight. And I know that you've been pulled in all directions these last couple of weeks because of the anniversary, so to speak. And I really appreciate you taking the time tonight to be with us.
Thank you, sir. I'm delighted to be here.
Great. So I want to remind all of you, if you want to hear the show, if you want more information about HIV and AIDS, if you want to question me or email me, tellthetruthfaster.com. You could also hear that whole documentary at pbs.org. I want to thank Dr. Gottlieb for being here with us tonight, and I want to remind you I'll be here next week again with Tell the Truth Faster on KXAM, 1310 a.m. in Phoenix. Have a great weekend.